The Stalin Epigram by Robert Littell. Narrated by Anne Flosnick and John Lee. Copyright 2009 by Robert Littell. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Scribner, a division of Simon & Schuster, Inc., and was produced in the year 2009 by Tantor Media, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. The voices in this book belong to Nadezhda Yakovlevna Mandelstam, Nadenka to her husband, the poet Osip Emilievich Mandelstam. She is 34 years old when we first hear her voice in 1934. Nikolai Sidorovich Vlasik, Stalin's personal bodyguard and occasional family photographer. He is in his mid-30s when we first meet him in the villa of the writer Maxim Gorky. Fikrit Trofimovich Shotman, a popular Soviet weightlifting champion. He is 32 years old when we come across him for the first time. Originally from Azerbaijan, Shotman won the silver medal at the All-European Games in Vienna in 1932. He subsequently retired from competition because of a botched operation on damaged knee cartilage. After his weightlifting career was cut short, he worked as a circus strongman. Anna Andreevna Akhmatova, born Anna Gerjenka, close friend to both Mandelstam and Pasternak, and a widely admired poet, even though the communist authorities have banned publication of her verse since the mid-20s. Tall and slender, she was the lover of the then little-known Italian painter Amadeo Modigliani in Paris in 1911, and sat for nude portraits he did of her. Akhmatova, a decadent poetess, according to her father, who forbid her to use the family name Gerjenka professionally, half nun, half harlot, in the eyes of the Bolshevik cultural watchdogs, is 45 years old when we meet her in these pages. Zinaida Zaitseva Antonova, a very young and very beautiful theatre actress, who is on intimate terms with the Mandelstams. Osip Emilievich Mandelstam, Osia to his wife Nadezhda. The publication of his first book of poetry in 1913, entitled Stone, established him in the eyes of many as the great Russian poet of the 20th century, a view that Stalin clearly shared. Boris Leonidovich Pasternak, famous lyric poet, 44, in 1934, son of the painter Leonid Osipovich Pasternak. His first book of poems, published in 1914, was The Twin in the Clouds, which may explain why Stalin, who had a certain admiration for Pasternak, nicknamed him the Cloud Dweller. It took years for Pasternak to accept that Stalin himself, and not the Czechists operating behind his back, was responsible for the deportations and purges and executions. Chapter 1. Nadezhda Yakovlevna, Saturday, the 13th of January, 1934. Since that white night our lifelines first coiled themselves around each other, 15 years ago come May Day, in Kiev, in a seedy bohemian cabaret called the Junk Shop. I must have heard Mandelstam give public reading scores of times. Still, the pure pleasure I take from the poetry of his poems is undiminished. There are moments when I am reduced to tears by the unspeakable beauty of the words, which take on another dimension when they enter one's consciousness through the ear, as opposed to the eye. How can I explain the miracle of it without sounding like the doting wife swooning in blind admiration? This high-strung, headstrong, life-glad homo poeticus, his description of himself casually offered up when he mooched that first cigarette from me in the junk shop, in what now seems like a previous incarnation, this nervous lover, of me and sundry others, is transfigured, becomes someone, something else. It goes without saying, but humour me if I say it. When he metamorphoses into someone else, So do I. With one arm sawing the air awkwardly, the arc of his body scores the rhyme and rhythm and layers of multiple meaning buried in the text. His head tossed back, the unmistakably Semitic Adam's apple working against the almost transparently thin skin of his pale throat, he loses himself in the thing we call poetry. Becomes the poem. When he materializes at the lectern at the start of an evening, there are usually several barely suppressed groans of mirth from the audience at the sight of this fussy, stage-frightened figure of a man dressed as if for his own funeral. On this particular evening I'm describing, he was wearing his only suit, a dark and itchy woolen twill, purchased at the hard currency shop, using coupons bought with a small inheritance I once received, along with a silk cravat, a relic of his trip to Paris before the Revolution, knotted around a starch-stiffened detachable collar. He reads as only the creator of the poem can read, with a slight pause for breath, an inaudible sucking in of air at the places where the lines break or bend or double back on themselves. This pause is critical to understanding the impact of a Mandelstam poem. I have compared notes with several of what Orsia calls his first readers, with him doing the reading and them doing the listening, and the savvier among them agree that he appears to be inventing the next line as he goes along. And this in turn gives even the listener who is familiar with the poem the eerie feeling that he is hearing these lines for the first time. That they haven't existed before, haven't been composed, reworked, polished, memorized, copied out on onion-skin paper by yours truly, and stashed away in teapots and shoes and female undergarments, in the hope against hope that our Czechists, when they come for him, will be unable to arrest his oeuvre. The line, the pause for breath, then the next line spilling freshly minted from his bloodless lips. That, my darlings, is at the heart of a Mandelstam recitation. For reasons I have not entirely grasped, the effect is even more remarkable when he is reading a love poem, and still more startling when the love poem in question isn't addressed to me, his best friend and comrade-in-arms and lawful wedded wife, but the plume of a theatre actress perched on the folding chair next to me in the front row of the dingy Literary Gazette editorial office, my fleshy arm linked through her slender arm, the back of my wrist grazing as if by inadvertence the curve of her very beautiful breast. At the lectern, Mandelstam turned away for a sip of water before starting to recite the last poem of the reading. The actress, who used her stage name, Zinaida Zaitseva Antonova, even off stage, leaned toward me, crushing her breast into my wrist. "Which poem is next, Nadezhda Yakovlevna?" she breathed, her voice husky with what I identified as sexual anticipation. "It is the one he composed for you, my dear. Shame-faced glances." Mandelstam set down the glass of water. "Mistress of shame-faced glances," he began, the stubby fingers of one hand splayed above his balding scalp, his pupils burning into the eyes of the woman next to me. "Suzerain of little shoulders, pacified the dangerous headstrong male." I leaned toward Zinaida. "Tonight you must conduct yourself decently," I instructed her. "You must stop teasing him."
"But it's you I tease," she whispered back, flaying playfully at my knuckles with the end of one of the long braids that plunged down her chest. "You excite me as much as he does."
"Why, like a Janissary, do I prize that swiftly reddening, tiny, piteous crescent of your lips? Don't be cross, my Turkish love. I'll be sewn up with you in a sack."
"In Ottoman Turkey," I told Zinaida, my lips grazing her ear, "adulterous wives were sewn into sacks with their lovers and cast into the sea." Never lifting her gaze from Mandelstam,
her reddening, tiny, piteous lips barely moving, she murmured,
"Oh, I shouldn't mind drowning like that."
"I stand at a hard threshold. Go, go, I say, yet stay a while."
"Hard threshold," Zinaida repeated.
"Hard indeed," I said with a snicker of suggestiveness. The 11 souls apart from us who had braved a January snowstorm to attend the reading broke into fervent applause. Two or three of the younger members of the audience stomped the wooden floorboards with the soles of their galoshes. The Literary Gazette's chief editor, a brave fellow who had published Mandelstam when Mandelstam was publishable, had been bitterly disappointed by the turnout, which he attributed to the sub-zero weather. Despite my husband's low profile in recent years, there were still many poetry lovers who considered him to be an iconic figure, so the editor had reassured us. We liked to think this was true, but we were no longer as sure of it as we had been in the late 20s, when a Mandelstam reading could fill a small concert hall. Mandelstam, suddenly breathing with difficulty, he suffered from occasional palpitation of the heart, swayed drunkenly, then stepped to the side and, steadying himself with a hand on the lectern, bowed from the waist.
"Has he been drinking?" Zinaida asked me above the clamour.
"He drank half a bottle of Georgian wine before the reading to calm his nerves," I told her. "But he is not intoxicated, if that's what you mean. I have never seen Mandelstam intoxicated on alcohol, only on words." Standing at the back of the room, the woman editorial director of a state publishing house, who was known as the Pigeon— it was widely believed she kept our Czechists informed of who said what at gatherings such as this one, called out, "Questions? Answers?" I waved a warning finger at my husband, hoping to get him to end the evening then and there. I feared the Pigeon would try to provoke him into saying something that could land him in hot water with our minders. When his instinct for survival, mine as well as his, had dominated his fine sense of right and wrong, he used to beat about the bush. No longer. In the months since we'd returned from the Crimea, where we'd seen hordes of rake-thin and bone-weary peasants, victims of Stalin's collectivization rampage, begging for crusts of bread at train stations along the way, Mandelstam had become dangerously outspoken. In recent weeks he had taken to quoting lines from an old 1931 poem of his whenever one of his acquaintances passed through our kitchen.
"How I'd love to speak my mind, to play the fool, to spit out truth."
I lived in dread he would do precisely that. I was terrified he would repeat in public things he'd confided to intimate friends in private— about the individual he called the Kremlin Mountaineer, about the utter failure of the Bolshevik Revolution to improve the lot of common people, about the transformation of Russia into a police state far worse than existed under the miserable Tsars, about how the communist apparatchiki, who kept an eye on artists, had deprived poets of the right to write boring poems. With a courteous wave of his hand, Mandelstam gave the woman leave to pose a question.
"Tell us, Osip Emilievich, where in your experience does poetry come from?"
"If I could be sure, I'd write more verse than I do."
Mandelstam savored the laughter his comment elicited.
"To respond to your question," he went on when it had subsided, "Pasternak claims the artist doesn't think up images, rather he gathers them from the street."
"Are you telling us that the poet is something like a garbage collector?" the Pigeon asked.
"Garbage represents the dregs of capitalist societies," Mandelstam observed, smiling blandly at the stool pigeon over the heads of his listeners. "Our Soviet socialist republics don't produce garbage, which explains the absence of garbage collectors."
This, too, drew a laugh. A functionary in the Moscow City Cooperative had recently been arrested on charges of sabotaging the capital's sanitation department by failing to hire a sufficient number of garbage collectors. No garbage, no garbage collectors, Zinaida agreed under her breath. She uttered it in a way that dispatched a pang of jealousy through my soul. For the instant it takes an eyelid to rinse the eye, she actually sounded like Mandelstam.
What about Akhmatova?
An intense young poet demanded from the row behind me.
As for Akhmatova, Mandelstam said, it is inaccurate to say she writes poetry. In point of fact, she writes it down. She opens a notebook and copies out lines that, during what she calls pre-lyrical anxiety, have already formed in her head. I have known her to substitute dots for a line that has not yet come to her, filling in the missing words later.
Closing his eyes, angling his head, exposing his throat, Mandelstam recited a verse of Akhmatova's that, like much of her recent poetry, remained unpublished.
If only you knew from what rubbish poetry grows. An angry cry, fresh smell of tar, mysterious mould on the wall, and suddenly lines ring out.
Enough of Pasternak and Akhmatova, Zinaida cried. Where does Mandelstam poetry come from, Osip Emilievich?
Mandelstam favoured her with a conspiratorial half-smile, as if they had covered this very ground during one of their so-called literary evenings together.
A poem begins with a barely audible voice ringing in the ear well before words are formed, he replied. This signals that the search for lost words has been initiated.
My lips move soundlessly, so I'm told, until eventually they begin to mouth disjointed words or phrases. Gradually this inner voice becomes more distinct, resolving itself into units of meaning, at which point the poem begins to knock like a fist on a window. For me, the writing of poetry has two phases. When the first words make themselves known, and when the last of the foreign words lodged like splinters in the body of the poem are driven out by the right words.
God, he makes it sound easy, Zinaida was saying, as we waited in the lobby downstairs for Mandelstam to finish signing slim volumes of his early poetry, or scraps cut from newspapers with more recent poems printed on them. A rarity, since our minders decided that Mandelstam wasn't contributing to the construction of socialism.
I could listen for the inner music from now until the Arctic melts, Zinaida continued, with what I took to be a practiced theatrical sigh, and still never come up with a poem. What Mandelstam has, I informed the young actress, whom we were both lusting after, is a gift from the gods. Either you have it or you don't. If you have it, the music and the words are delivered to you on a silver tray.
Is it true, Nadezhda, what they say about your knowing every poem he's ever written?
I am, of course, extremely familiar with his several volumes of published poetry, but our literary minders pretty much stopped publishing Mandelstam's verse, with the occasional exception, 6 years ago. In the late 20s he went through what he calls his deaf-mute phase, when he abandoned the writing of poetry entirely. Every poem he has composed since I have had to memorize. I repeat them to myself day in and day out. This way, if anything happens to him, the poems could survive.
And if, God forbid, something were to happen to you?
The little persifleur had touched a nerve. I wondered if Mandelstam had spoken of the matter with her. Knowing him, probably. Confiding intimate secrets was an unerring way of gaining a woman's confidence. Of persuading her you were not violent, in order to seduce her into what, in the end, is an essentially violent act. You have put your finger on a sore point between my husband and me, I admitted. I was not above sharing intimate secrets to tempt someone of either sex into my bed. Mandelstam has few illusions about his own survival or that of his oeuvre. Since Stalin decreed that nothing contradicting the party line could be published, Mandelstam considers his fate has been sealed. Let's face it, An unpublished poet makes as much noise as a tree falling in a forest with nobody around to hear it. Stalin's position, which boils down to either you are for us or you are against us, my darlings, leaves no middle ground for the likes of Mandelstam. So you see, my dear Zinaida, my husband had something in addition to his literary legacy in mind when he encouraged me to commit his poems to memory. As we have chosen not to have children, he has convinced himself that my being the last repository of his oeuvre would give me an incentive to survive.
Would it?
I must have shrugged, which is how I usually evade answering silly questions. Who can say what, besides the hard-to-kick habit of breathing, or the ephemeral gratification of sexual congress, or the utter satisfaction of disappointing those in power who wish you dead, would push one to cling to life? Zinaida studied her reflection in the glass door.
If my husband were to disappear into a camp, they have been arresting agronomists of late to account for the long lines at bread shops, it would solve all my problems.
She tossed her pretty head to suggest she was making a joke, but I knew enough about her marriage. Her husband was 12 years her senior, and had little interest in the theatre or in the arts, to understand she was at least half serious.
I would be legally entitled to divorce him and keep the apartment, as well as my Moscow residence permit.
Mandelstam turned up before I could educate her. Wives of enemies of the people were more often than not being sent into exile with their arrested husbands these days. Catching sight of him, Zinaida arranged the shabby fox stole about her delicate neck, so that the head of the animal, its beady eyes surveying the world with unblinking indifference, was resting on her breast. Never one to let pass something he considered sexually suggestive, Mandelstam noticed this immediately.
For the first time in my 43 years of existence, I am green with jealousy of a dead fox, he confessed, causing Zinaida to avert her eyes in feigned embarrassment.
She was, you will remember, the mistress, and I might add the master, of shame-faced glances. I pulled the ratty collar of my late aunt's winter coat, made, if you believed my husband, of skunk fur, up around my neck, and dragged open the heavy door of the building. A blast of icy air, filled with frozen clots of snow, singed our faces. Mandelstam lowered the ear flaps of his fur-lined leather cap.
"Cigarettes," he announced, and linking his arms through ours, he pulled us into the wintry Moscow street.
Like many men, perhaps I should say like most men, Mandelstam sailed through life with a cargo of manias. He lived in terror of his muse and his erection one day deserting him. He lived in everlasting fear of fear. He never thought twice about where the next ruble or the next hard currency coupon would come from. He simply assumed that when he needed one or the other, I would somehow magically produce it, which was more often than not the case. But he worried himself sick that he would run out of cigarettes in the middle of the night, when the ringing in his ear roused him from a troubled sleep, and he spent the restless hours before dawn prowling the minuscule rooms of the flat we were lucky enough to have, sucking on cigarette after cigarette as he waited for the arrival of those disjointed words and phrases. And so, having sponged 2 cigarettes from members of the audience upstairs, and discovering that he himself had only 5 Herzegovina floors left in a crumpled packet, he led us, gripping the white knob of the walking stick he had begun using because of occasional shortness of breath, on a mad quest for cheap cigarettes. We wound up, our heads bent into an eye-tearing snowstorm, making the rounds of the coffee shops and the canteens in the neighbourhood, hoping to beg or borrow or buy a full packet of cigarettes. It was at the third stop, actually a late-night canteen for trolley car workers, hidden in a small alleyway behind the Kremlin terminal, that Mandelstam found what he was looking for. A shady character who claimed to have a vendor's license was selling individual Bulgarian cigarettes from a cigar box, along with something he wasn't looking for. humiliation.
"Osip Emilievich, what brings you out on a night like this? It's New Year's Day, according to the old-style Julian calendar. So, happy New Year to you, friend."
The voice came from an unshaven ruffian holding court at two tables dragged together at the back of the canteen. The five young women around him, all wearing padded winter overcoats and sipping what I supposed to be vodka from tea glasses, turned to gape at us as if we were ghouls wandered in from a cemetery. I could tell from the way Mandelstam saluted the speaker with his half-raised walking stick that he wasn't sure of his identity. Mandelstam often had a hard time putting names to faces when people were out of context. "Hello to you, Ugo Zhitkin," I called, and I could see my husband nodding in relief as he grasped the identity of his interlocutor.
"Ugo Zhitkin, at long last," my husband exclaimed,
turning from the seller of Bulgarian cigarettes.
"I have been leaving messages with your secretary for weeks." "This time of year is always a madhouse," Ugo Zhitkin grumbled, as if that would excuse his failure to respond. "A thousand and one things to do, a thousand and one people to see."
Mandelstam had learned from Pasternak 2 or 3 months before that the editor Ugo Zhitkin was offering hard cash for original manuscripts for the new Literary Fund library. The only manuscripts my husband possessed of unpublished and, according to our literary minders, unpublishable poems, had been written out by me, and he would not part with these, even if someone were reckless enough to want them. We were desperate for money. My translation work had dried up, as Mandelstam had become non grata in the literary world, and we were ashamed to ask Pasternak or Akhmatova for yet another loan that we had no hope of repaying. Which is how we came up with the scheme of concocting a manuscript that Mandelstam could then pass off as an original and sell. Bent over our small linoleum-covered kitchen table, with a crust of bread under one leg to keep it from wobbling, he copied every poem from the original green-covered edition of Stone, his first published volume, into a grade-school exercise book. The chore took the better part of 2 full days. Getting it to look authentic became something of an obsession for us. Mandelstam remembered or invented earlier versions of some of the poems and filled the pages with crossed-out words and lines. When he finished, we took turns thumbing through the exercise book until the edges of the pages became dog-eared, after which we aged the manuscript by baking it under a low flame in a neighbour's oven until the paper turned brittle and yellow. Throwing himself into the project, Mandelstam even went so far as to copy off cryptic notes to himself and a recipe for Polish borscht, a heavy-handed reference to his having been born in Warsaw, on the blank pages. The finished product was carefully wrapped in a page from a 1913 newspaper that I pinched from the university library and personally delivered by Mandelstam to Ugo Zhitkin's secretary, who agreed to bring it to her boss's attention the moment he returned to Moscow.
"Come drink in the New Year with us,"
Ugo Zhitkin was saying, waving to the free chairs at the end of the two tables. He was clearly hoping to avoid the subject of Mandelstam's original manuscript of Stone.
"The girls and I,"
the females at the tables, who enjoyed the reputation of being his protégés, were counting on Ugo Zhitkin to use his considerable influence to get their short stories or poems or plays into print. What they gave him in return for this service was the subject of more than one supper conversation in Moscow.
"The girls and I are celebrating something beside the Julian New Year." "Listen, Osip Emilievich, this is a great occasion in Soviet history. We've just come away from seeing our first talking motion picture. Surely you've read the fabulous review in Pravda. There are some who are convinced that Stalin himself wrote it, since he is known to admire the film. I'm talking about Chapayev, by the Vasilyev brothers. It's based on the Formanov novel about the Civil War hero Vasily Chapayev."
The expression on the face of the Mandelstam, who no longer beat about the bush, darkened. I knew what was coming, and tried to catch his eye and head him off. No such luck.
"The trouble with Soviet films, silent or talking," he allowed, slipping into an exaggerated Georgian drawl that was supposed to remind people of how Stalin spoke Russian, "is that they are marked by a wealth of detail and a poverty of ideas. But then propaganda doesn't need ideas."
Mandelstam might as well have poured ice water from the Moscow River over Ugor Zhitkin and his entourage.
"What is he saying?" gasped one of the girls.
"He is suggesting that Soviet filmmakers are propagandists," another said.
"It sounds awfully like an anti-Soviet declaration to me," a third girl observed uncomfortably.
Rummaging in his pockets, Mandelstam came up with the receipt the secretary had written out for one original manuscript of the 1913 edition of Stone. He strode across the room, past the streetcar drivers and conductors who were fortifying themselves for the night shift with stale beer, and flattened the receipt on the table in front of Ugor Zhitkin.
"I've been meaning to get back to you about this," Ugor Zhitkin said.
"Have you looked at my manuscript?"
"The value of any given manuscript depends on the writer's specific gravity. Frankly, the general opinion is that you are a minor poet. I am afraid it's not worth more than 200 rubles.
200 rubles?
His hands trembling in rage, Mandelstam brought his walking stick crashing down on the table. The tea glasses jumped. Two of the girls sprang to their feet in fright. Ugor Zhitkin turned pale.
"Stone!"
Mandelstam plunged on, the metal tip of his stick tapping the tabletop,
"is a classic of 20th-century Russian poetry, so the reviewers concluded at the time of its publication. You paid 5 times what you're offering me for a piece of shit by—"
Mandelstam named a writer whose three-act drama glorifying Stalin's role in the Civil War was playing to full houses in Moscow. "My great friend, the poet Anna Akhmatova, claims there are moments in life that are so momentous, it appears as if the earth has stopped dead in its tracks for the beat of a heart." This was such a moment in the life of Osip Mandelstam.
"Who are you?" one of the girls demanded. "Who is he?"
I caught my breath. Mandelstam elevated his chin.
"I am the poet Mandelstam."
"There's no poet of that name," another girl declared. "Once, long ago, there was such a poet."
"I thought Mandelstam was dead," said the first girl.
The earth resumed rotating around its axis, though nothing would ever be the same.
"The 200 rubles,
Ugor Zhitkin said, determined not to let himself be pushed around in front of his protégés, "is a take-it-or-leave-it proposition." My husband started toward the door, then turned back to the editor.
"You are living proof that a man's character is written on his face," Mandelstam said so agreeably it didn't dawn on Ugor Zhitkin he was being insulted. "Do you happen to have cigarettes?"
Ugor Zhitkin collected the 2 partially filled packets on the table and handed them to Mandelstam.
"Happy 1934 to you all the same," he said.
I saw my husband nod, as if he were confirming something he didn't like about himself.
"I accept the 200 rubles, he announced.
"Come around in the morning,"
Ugor Zhitkin said, barely swallowing a smile.
"My secretary will have an envelope for you."
Kicking at a drift of snow outside the canteen, Mandelstam managed a cranky laugh.
"Mandelstam dead," he said, making no effort to conceal the anguish in his voice.
The words that then emerged from his mouth seemed to be transported on small billows of frozen breath.
"Dead, but not yet buried."
I can tell you I shivered, not from the gut-numbing cold, but from a presentiment of terror. What in the world did he mean by dead but not yet buried? Zinaida asked the hour. Mandelstam never wore a wristwatch, but always knew the time. He was never off by more than a minute or two.
It is 11:20. Too late for you to return to your own flat. You must come home with us and spend the night.
I took Zinaida's elbow. We simply will not accept no for an answer, darling girl.
You owe it to me as a poet, Mandelstam said a bit frantically. Nothing so depends on eroticism as poetry.
That being the case, she said with a pout, I shall have to say...
I could see my husband was hanging on her reply. The prospect of an erotic encounter with this gorgeous creature had pushed from his mind everything that had happened to him that evening.
I shall have to say yes.
The three of us fell into lockstep as we headed toward Herzen House and our flat.
I outfoxed that asinine Ugo Zhitkin, didn't I? Mandelstam said, his spirits soaring. 200 rubles for a phony manuscript. Come along, Aida. Come along, Nadenka. If I am unable to publish poetry, I can at least produce counterfeit manuscripts until the inkwells run dry in Russia.
Nushchokin Street was caked with ice. Linking arms, we made as if to skate the last 30 meters to the writer's building. The hallway inside our wing reeked from the rancid insecticide used to kill bedbugs. We were convulsed with laughter as we threw open the door to our ground-floor flat, and flinging the overcoats to the floor, sprawled short of breath on the bedraggled sofa in the living room. We could hear the Swiss clock, with the heavy weight hanging on the end of the chain, ticking away in the kitchen. The radiator under the window that I'd painted rose-red hissed and belched as if it were human. Somewhere above us a toilet flushed and water rushed through pipes in the walls, but nothing could dampen our spirits. The telephone in the niche at the end of the corridor started ringing and kept at it until one of the tenants answered and then shouted,
"Lifshitz, Pyotr Semyonovich, your wife would like to have a word with your mistress," which set us to giggling like schoolchildren.
When I'd caught my breath, I said something about how sexual relationships were never uncomplicated in this socialist paradise of ours. Mandelstam set 3 thick kitchen tumblers on our makeshift coffee table, actually an old suitcase plastered with stickers from Heidelberg, where he'd spent a semester in 1910, and poured out what was left in the bottle of Georgian Kvanchkara, then raised his glass.
"I propose we drink to the health of those who are responsible for this happy life of ours."
"No, no, let's drink to the 3 of us," I suggested.
"To the 3 of us," Zinaida exclaimed.
"Well then, to the 3 of us," my husband happily agreed, and we clanked glasses and drank off the wine. 3 is a lucky number," Mandelstam said, puffing his cravat free as he licked the last of the red wine from his lips, and he launched into a self-conscious soliloquy, one that I'd heard before, about how the Bolshevik Revolution had had sexual as well as social and political consequences. "In the 20s, he told our guest, "the ménage à trois began to be widely practiced in intellectual circles. Everyone remembers the relationship between Osip and Lily Brick and Mayakovsky. Shostakovich had an open marriage with Nina Vazar. Akhmatova once lived with the very beautiful Olga Sudeikina and the composer Artur Luria."
I supplied the succulent details. "She used to say they could never decide which of them he was in love with, so they both loved him and each other."
Mandelstam said, "I speak for my wife, don't I, Nadenka, when I say we consider a 3-way marriage to be a fortress no outsider can conquer."
"Is he accurately representing your views?" Zinaida demanded.
"Yes," I said. "It seems to me that in this dead country, where nothing can be reborn, the ménage à trois is the ideal citadel."
"Did you ever see any of his conquests as a threat to you?" Zinaida persisted.
I exchanged looks with my husband.
When our paths first crossed, in a cabaret in Kiev, we appeared to be ships passing in the night, until, as he later put it, I blew him out of the water. Soon after we met, Mandelstam and I were separated by the Civil War. I was your age at the time, and missed him terribly. He wound up in Petersburg, where he had a 3-month fling with Olga Arbenina. What I resented most was not Arbenina. I can understand any female of the species being attracted to Mandelstam. No, what I resented most was Mandelstam. When he took up with that woman, he and I were on intimate terms. He called me sister and addressed me using the familiar tear. But when he got around to writing me after meeting Arbenina, he switched into the formal vieux, and I understood we would have to begin from zero in our relationship.
"What did you do?" Zinaida asked, looking eagerly from one to the other.
"The answer is as plain as the beauty mark on your chin," Mandelstam said. "We started again from scratch." And he added, more for my ears than Zinaida's, "Loving a third person is not without risks."
Zinaida wanted to know if we had ever come close to splitting up.
"There was a bearded writer in the mid-20s," I admitted.
"Oh, do tell me who it was," she demanded.
I could only smile at the memory. "His last name began with the initial T. More I will not tell you. It was a time when I was mutinying against my husband's definition of a couple. He expected me to abandon my life to him, renounce my own self, become a part of him. This mutiny took the form of falling head over heels in love with T. But I fortunately came to my senses."
Zinaida turned to Mandelstam. "Do you still expect Nadezhda to abandon her life and become part of you?"
"We have since met on a middle ground," he replied.
"Recount your first experience as a ménage à trois. Were you nervous? Were you inhibited?"
"For me," Mandelstam said, "the baptism of fire was with two sisters who acted in motion pictures." "That was simply too much for me, even if we were both of us in full seductive flight, so to speak." "He is lying through his teeth," I exploded. "Before we met, he knew nothing of such things. He would undress in the dark, for God's sake. I was the one who initiated him."
"But you don't respond to the question, Nadezhda Yakovlevna. Were you inhibited the first time?"
"The first time one is always timid, darling girl. You are fortunate in that you have us to light the way." Zinaida crushed a fold of my long skirt in her fingers and pulled me closer.
"I confess that I am embarrassed," she said softly, her cheeks burning, her eyes aglow.
"I am able to fix that," Mandelstam said impatiently. The foreplay was taking longer than he had anticipated. "Take off your clothing, and the three of us shall repair to the bedroom for a conversation that doesn't require a knowledge of dialectical materialism." I reached to undo the top buttons of her blouse, and, placing the tips of my fingers on the swell of her breast, kissed her lightly on the lips. Mandelstam removed his jacket and his collar, and, offering a hand, led her toward the small bedroom. "There were English poets," he told her, "who believed that for each ejaculation a man loses a day of his life."
"Does that suggest the woman gains a day?" Zinaida inquired with feigned innocence.
"Not," Mandelstam said mischievously, "unless she swallows."
Zinaida's little shoulders shook with soundless laughter. "I should not feel comfortable lengthening my life at the expense of shortening yours."
"Don't worry your pretty head over it," I remarked as I followed them through the doorway. What I left unsaid was this. It was the poems that failed to beat about the bush, not the orgasms with this bewitching sea-nymph, which risked to cut short Mandelstam's lifeline. Not to mention mine. When we'd burst through the door of the flat earlier, I'd instantly detected what my husband, too enthralled by Zinaida's petal of rose perfume, had missed. The stale aroma of a strong tobacco that only men smoked. And I noticed, as I was meant to, that the glass ashtray on the windowsill was filled with cigarette ends. I didn't have the heart to spoil Mandelstam's Lucullan banquet by telling him we'd had visitors. At least for the space of a few hours he would put behind him the agony of no longer being published, the indignity of reading his poems to 11 people, the humiliation of once long ago there was such a poet. Dear God in heaven, while he still has a muse and an erection, arrange things so the sun will simply fail to rise tomorrow morning. Amen.
Chapter 2. Nikolai Vlasic. Monday, the 19th of February, 1934. The celebrated Maxim Gorky himself, wearing a belted beige greatcoat with an astrakhan collar and strutting like a white Russian doorman at a Bagal cabaret, was patrolling the portico when I pulled up in the Motorpol Packard. "You will be Vlasic," he called out in a shrill voice, looming alongside the automobile to haul open the door on the passenger side, before my chauffeur could circle around and do it himself. "At your beck and call," I shot back, flashing a tight little smile meant to convey that I was anything but. Nikolai Sidorovich Vlasic was at the beck and call of only one man in the universe, the Kaid in the Kremlin, we called the Khozayin. That's a Georgian expression meaning head of household, though the household in question sprawled from the Baltic to the Black Sea, from the Arctic ice cap to the Pacific Ocean. Gorky, his hair slicked back with pomade and a wispy handlebar mustache trickling off his upper lip, led the way into the gaudy foyer of his Art Nouveau villa. An enormous painting of an emaciated naked lady picnicking with two fully clothed gentlemen on the bank of a river filled an entire wall. You could see a smaller version of the same painting reflected in the steel-framed mirror on the opposite wall. "Playing host to Comrade Stalin is a new experience for me," Gorky declared, pitching his greatcoat into the outstretched arms of a servant. "Where do we begin?" I can't say I thought much of the villa or the naked lady or Gorky, whom I'd seen from a distance at Kremlin receptions when Russia's greatest writer, as Pravda called him when it recounted a meeting between Gorky and a young American author named B. Schulberg, was trotted out on cultural occasions. I'd never read anything Gorky'd written, not even his The Canal Named for Stalin, nor did I intend to. Not that I had much time for books. My official duties as the Khozayin's personal bodyguard, factotum, and occasional family photographer barely left evenings free to service my concubines. According to the dossier provided by second deputy chairman of the Cheka, Genrikh Yagoda, Gorky, also known as Alexei Maximovich Peshkov, was one of those vegetarians, my boss's delicious turn of phrase, derogatory, meant to distinguish between the faint-hearted revolutionists and the red meat-eaters, who had abandoned Lenin in the early 20s when the going got a bit sticky. For a time he had been living abroad with a famous beauty of her day, Mura Budberg, who had previously been the mistress of Britain's consul general in Moscow at the time of the revolution. Yagoda told me he suspected the Budberg woman of spying, but he couldn't figure out for whom. The Khozayin, for reasons beyond me, had lured Gorky back to the homeland from his lavish Italian exile in the late 20s by offering him this villa in the Lenin Hills that once belonged to the millionaire Ryabushinsky, as well as a couple of duchies, one near Stalin's, not far from Moscow, the other in the Crimea, each resplendent enough to set the mouths of visitors to watering, so I've been informed. In case this wasn't bait enough, the boss, with a stroke of the pen, changed the name of Nizhny Novgorod, the writer's birth city on the Volga, to Gorky. It was rumored about that Yagoda, who also came from Nizhny Novgorod, was furious the city had not been named after him. No wonder Gorky came back to Russia. As Christ is my witness, I'd seriously consider taking up residence in America if the Khozayin in Washington, that crass capitalist F. Roosevelt, agreed to change the name of Chicago to Vlasikgrad. Jussis, the Lithuanian who had been working for the Khozayin as long as I had, longer even, turned up behind me with my chauffeur, an Ossetian tribesman from the mountains of Georgia. Talk about red meat-eaters. The Ossete had been a Tsarist prison guard in his youth. I gestured for them to search the house, and, fingering the small German pistols in the pockets of their leather jackets, they set off in different directions to explore it from attic to cellar. "We'll start with the guest list," I told Gorky as we walked down several steps, our footfalls echoing off tiled walls, into the long-mirrored reception hall lined with Chinese vases where my boss would meet the writers. Gorky, agitated, thumbed his false teeth back into place. "But the list of guests has already been vetted by Kermit Stalin's secretariat." "I am the head of the Khozayin security detail," I informed the fair-weather friend of Lenin's, who had jumped ship at the sight of spilled blood. "It's me who has the ultimate responsibility for his safety. The list, if you please. The list, even if you don't please. I am a big-bodied man who keeps fit by doing push-ups every morning and moves with the agility of someone half his weight. It has been said of me that I am able to walk across a room without provoking the creaking of floorboards under my feet. Browbeating vegetarians is what I do to work up an appetite." Gorky produced a typescript from the breast pocket of a European suit jacket with ridiculously wide lapels. Settling onto one of the steel and celluloid chairs, I went over the page, which had 38 names on it, selected by Gorky, typed in two neat columns. I uncapped my fountain pen and scratched lines through the names of 3 film writers and 3 novelists and 2 editors, whom I knew to be on Yagoda's shit list. When I handed the page back to Gorky, he looked rattled. "These people have already been invited. They will turn up at my door in 3/4 of an hour. "You are not the only host here. You are the head of the Writers' Union. You will station yourself at the entranceway, Comrade Gorky. Tick off the names as the guests arrive. The ones whose names have lines through them are to be turned away." "What the devil will I tell them?" "You are an inventor of fictions. Tell them whatever comes into your head. Only be sure they do not get in. Now let me see the seating plan." I studied the page he handed me, which corresponded to the long table that ran the length of the reception room. The Khozayin, according to Gorky's plan, was to be seated at the head of the table. "Comrade Stalin never presides at receptions," I informed the writer. "You yourself will sit at the head of the table. He will sit immediately to your right with his back to the wall. Instruct your servers that the food he eats and the wine he drinks will be supplied by me. If he desires tea, I will pour it from a thermos flask." Crossing out names and writing in new ones, I rearranged the seating order so that my boss would be surrounded by writers and editors whom I knew to be members of the party, and returned the page to Gorky, along with one of the checker's manila file cards with the names of 3 of his servants typed on it. "Get rid of them for the afternoon," I instructed the great writer. "We don't want them coming anywhere near the Khozayin." Gorky squinted at the index card in disbelief, and for a moment I thought he might have more spine than his detractors gave him credit for. "These people," he blurted out, "have been with me since I returned to Russia." I glanced impatiently at my wristwatch. "They have Israelite names, Comrade Gorky," I said, assuming that would be explanation enough. "Israelite names? Some of the comrades closest to Stalin are of Jewish extraction. Zinoviev, Kamenev, Kaganovich, even your Czechist Genrikh Yagoda. Lenin himself is said to have had Jewish blood." I cut him off. "The arch-traitor Bronstein Trotsky is an Israelite. We are concerned that he will attempt to assassinate the Khozayin with the assistance of the international Zionist conspiracy." Gorky rolled his eyes in dismay. "Inviting the Khozayin to meet with writers under my roof has turned out to be more complicated than I imagined when Stalin suggested the idea." The first of the writers and editors, arriving in private automobiles or taxicabs or on foot, began turning up as the chimes in the Kremlin tower across the river tolled high noon. I could see the hunched figure of Yusis, standing immediately inside the front door, scrutinizing the guests with his unsmiling eyes as they removed their winter coats and piled them on the tables set out for that purpose in the foyer. Gorky was arguing with 2 men at the door, throwing up his hands helplessly as he turned them away. My Ossetian chauffeur had taken up position in front of the swinging doors leading from the reception hall to the kitchen. I kept an eye on things for a while, then made my way to the servants' entrance off the laundry room next to the kitchen, which gave on to an unpaved alleyway behind the villa. At 1:30, a 1911 Rolls-Royce with teardrop fenders turned into the alley and pulled to a stop at the back of the villa. At both ends of the alleyway I could make out soldiers armed with rifles, fitted with bayonets, blocking off access from the street. Two of Yagoda's people in civilian clothing sprang from the car. One of them came up to me and saluted while the other held open the rear door of the Rolls-Royce. The Hossein emerged from the automobile, clearly in no hurry to get where he was going. He loathed public functions and held all writers, with the possible exception of Mikhail Sholokhov, the poet Pasternak, and another poet with a distinctly Israelite name that escapes me now, in low esteem, inasmuch as he considered them to be careerists, who served themselves first and the revolution a distant second. My boss, with a worker's cap on his head and a plain army greatcoat thrown over his shoulders, spotted me at the door and raised a hand to acknowledge my presence. A cigarette bobbed on his lower lip. He treated himself to a last drag before flicking it into an open garbage pail. Comrade Stalin, who was vigilant about the image he presented to the world, made a point of never being seen in public or photographed smoking a cigarette. Walking with that distinctive pigeon-toed gait that actors who played him on stage imitated so artfully, he came through the doorway. "Everything in order, Vlasic?" he muttered. I nodded once. I'd been the Hossein's bodyguard since the Civil War. He knew me well enough to know I wouldn't let him set foot in a building if it wasn't. "What kind of humor is the great Gorky in today? I get the impression he thinks he is doing you a favor." A guttural laugh worked its way up from the back of the Hossein's throat. "Asshole." He shrugged the great coat off his shoulders. One of Yagoda's people snatched it before it hit the floor and folded it over the back of a bench. Under the coat, Comrade Stalin was dressed in one of the rough peasant's tunics he favored when he appeared in public, and baggy woolen trousers tucked mujik style into soft leather boots with thick heels designed to make him taller. When he reviewed parades from the top of Lenin's tomb, he stood on a wooden milk box, so his head would be as high as, or higher than, those of the marshals and Politburo members around him. I happened to know this because I supplied the milk box. I followed my boss through the laundry room and the kitchen, and reached past him to push open the swinging doors leading to the reception hall. Word of his arrival spread like wildfire through the room. Conversations died away. The writers and editors, who were already sitting at the table, jumped to their feet. The others, milling around clutching small glasses of pertsovka, a fiery vodka aged with pepper, stood to attention, looking for all the world like gymnasium students in the presence of their schoolmaster. My boss waved his good hand in a vague greeting that took in everyone. A fawning Gorky materialized out of the crowd and made a great show of welcoming him to the villa the Hossein had given him. Comrade Stalin pulled a Dunhill pipe from the pocket of his tunic and carefully packed the bowl from a pouch, which I'd filled with tobacco shredded from one of his favorite brands of cigarettes, Kazbek Papirosi. Gorky produced a silver pocket lighter and cupped the flame over the bowl of the pipe as Comrade Stalin sucked it into life. For a moment the two of them were obscured by a cloud of smoke. I ambled between knots of guests to be closer to the Hossein. As I drew nearer, a beam of sun streaming through the skylight caught his face like a spotlight, and I was struck once again by how worn out the boss appeared. He was in his middle 50s and looked his age, but acted older. His mustache, which his 8-year-old daughter, Svetlana, complained of being prickly, drooped like a weedy plant in need of watering. He had what we laughingly called a Kremlin complexion that came from working 15-hour days. His skin, pitted with childhood smallpox scars, had turned a sickly sallow. His rotting teeth, clearly visible as he gnawed on the stem of his pipe, seemed to mirror the general decay of his body. For those of us who were on intimate terms with Comrade Stalin, it was no secret that he was waging a rearguard action against a persuasive despair. Oh, he could put on a show in public. But most mornings found him, after yet another sleepless night, in a black mood ranting about his chronic tonsillitis, or the rheumatic throbbing in his deformed arm, or an ache in a tooth that the dentist Shapiro, another Israelite for me to worry about, had failed to alleviate during a visit to the Kremlin clinic the previous afternoon. The women in his entourage, Molotov's wife, the Jewess Polina, Bukharin's new bride, the beautiful 20-year-old Anna Larina, thought he had never gotten over the sudden death, a year and a half before, of his young wife, Nadezhda. Of course no one spoke of this in front of him, lest his legendary Georgian-Ossetian temper, which could burst like a summer squall, put an abrupt end to the conversation, not to mention the Kremlin pass that gave you access to the court. Everyone agreed that the absence of a serious female companion contributed to the Hossein's depression. I myself had casually offered to introduce him to one or several of my concubines, but he had declined so brusquely it discouraged me from raising the subject a second time. The men close to Comrade Stalin, his longtime secretary, his chief of staff, assorted members of the Politburo, even Yagoda, had another take on the situation. For them, the boss's obsession with forcing the peasantry into collectives had come home to haunt him. Tales of deserted Ukrainian villages, of cattle cars filled with starving peasants, of rampaging mobs burning seed grain and killing livestock, circulated in the Kremlin. The forbidden word famine was being spread about. Was Comrade Stalin, the man of steel who had held fast during the roll of the dice we referred to as the revolution, as well as the brutal civil war that followed, losing his nerve? Was he afraid the chaos he had unleashed would spiral out of control? That the Ukrainian breadbasket would be lost forever to the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics? That his Politburo colleagues, faced with the collapse of Bolshevik power, would plot behind his back to strip him of his leadership role, or his life? The cigarette tobacco in his pipe seemed to settle the boss's nerves. Sinking into the seat to the right of Gorky, he even managed to chat stiffly with the writers and editors nearest him.
That's a good question. History books skim over this period of Stalin's life because it would be unseemly for a Bolshevik to draw attention to it, he told a writer, speaking a rich Russian with a thick Georgian accent, using the third-person form of speech he favored in public appearances like this one. His mother, Ekaterina, thank God, is still very much alive, is a certified saint. In those days, the family lived in a dilapidated shack behind a church in Gori, a dreary sprawl of a town in a mountainous backwater of Georgia next to the Kura River, which was so muddy, fish drowned in it. She made ends meet, keeping house for a local priest and taking in washing from the bourgeois housewives who lived on the side of town with paved streets and garbage collection. The last time Stalin visited his mother, you're not going to credit this, she asked him what he did for a living. Stalin explained that he worked in the Kremlin and helped govern the country. She shook her head in disgust and said he would have done better to finish the seminary and become a priest. Can you imagine Stalin, a devout atheist, as a priest?
The Hossein tapped the toes and heels of his boots on the floor in a little jig, a sign that he was beginning to enjoy the conversation. One thing my boss relished was talking about himself. It was hard to get him started, but once started, it was harder to stop him. As for Stalin's late and very lamented father, Vissarion, he went on, he was a shoemaker by trade, a hard-working breadwinner and a model proletarian, though there's little chance he ever knew the meaning of the word. He struggled selflessly to make life better for his wife and children. Vissarion, to Stalin's everlasting regret, died before he could really get to know him, but his father remains a shining example of what a man should be. You asked about Stalin's names. His mother called him Soso when he was a kid, which is the Georgian equivalent of Joey. Later, when Stalin went underground and began his revolutionary activities, he called himself Koba, after a fictional Caucasian outlaw.
And where did the name Stalin originate? The fat editor asked.
Around us, the waiters were serving chilled white Georgian wine to the guests. Eusis came over with a bottle he'd selected at random from the cartons in the kitchen, uncorked it in front of the boss's eyes and half-filled his glass. The Hossein wet his lips on the wine.
Koba began using the underground name Stalin in 1913, I think.
Yes, yes, it was 1913. He took the name from a bosomy apple-cheeked Bolshevik whose bed he was sharing at the time. Her name was Ludmila Stahl. He transformed the Stahl into Stalin.
Stalin, man of steel, Gorky said approvingly. Wonderful story.
An editor, diagonally across the table from Comrade Stalin, said,
"Can I print it in my newspaper?"
My boss bristled. "Out of the question," he snapped. "We Bolsheviks pride ourselves on being modest, on discouraging a cult based on our persons." While the waiters were distributing silver trays piled high with small salmon wedges, I had Eusis retrieve from the boot of my Packard the straw hamper containing the food that had been prepared at a Cheka laboratory, and then sealed and marked, certified free of poisonous elements. The Hossein, who was something of an expert on poisons, he once informed me that prussic acid smelled like burnt almonds, hemlock like a rat's nest, oleander like chocolate, arsenic like a decomposing supper, categorically refused to eat at public receptions unless he broke the seal and opened the hamper himself. Reaching around him, I set the box down on the table. Comrade Stalin slit the seal with one of his nicotine-stained fingernails and sniffed at the cold piroshki filled with ground pork before popping one into his mouth. At the head of the table, Gorky climbed to his feet and tapped a knife against a bottle of mineral water. Everyone talks about Lenin and Leninism, but Lenin has been gone a long time. I say, long live Stalin and Stalinism, he called, raising a wine glass over his head. Long life, energy, wisdom, and stamina to triumph over the many enemies of the first socialist state on the planet Earth. In an instant, the guests were on their feet. To Comrade Stalin, they cried in chorus, and drank off the white wine. Stalin wagged a pinky at Gorky. How can you say that? Lenin was a fist. Stalin a little finger. The guest at Stalin's end of the table who heard the comment broke into applause. I took a turn around the kitchen to be sure the servants with Israelite surnames had been sent home. When I returned to my post near the Khozayin, I discovered he was telling a joke. The boss could charm the skin off a snake if he put his mind to it. If you've heard it before, stop me, he informed the guests within earshot. So, a Turk asks a Serb why they were always waging war. For plunder, the Serb responds. We are a poor people and hope to win some booty. How about you? The Serb asks. We fight for honor and for glory, the Turk replies. At which point the Serb says, the Khozayin started to chuckle at his own story. He says, everyone fights for what he doesn't have. Everyone fights for what he doesn't have, Gorky repeated, and he burst into peals of girlish laughter. The guests around Stalin slapped the table appreciatively. After a moment, someone asked if the Khozayin thought Soviet communism would spread to other industrialized countries. Comrade Stalin was in his element now. When we Bolsheviks took power, he said, several of the more naive comrades thought our uprising would spark revolutions across capitalist Europe. Someone even suggested, half-jokingly, that we ought to construct a high tower on the frontier and post a lookout to keep an eye peeled for world revolution. Stalin, who believed in constructing socialism in one country at a time, Russia first, told them such a scheme would have the advantage of providing permanent employment for at least one worker. Well, you get the point. Which countries are ripe for revolution? Certainly not America, where everyone is too busy accumulating wealth, or holding on to what they've already accumulated to take to the streets. The French are too preoccupied with eating and drinking and fornicating to make a revolution. As for Great Britain, the English are unable to rebel against the king, because revolution would involve ignoring signs that prohibit walking on lawns. That leaves the Germans, Gorky offered. Every child knows the Germans would be incapable of storming a railroad station without first purchasing tickets to the quay, the boss said with a smirk. The people around Comrade Stalin, seduced by the Khozayin's conviviality, began to relax. Mikhail Sholokhov, sitting across from my boss on Gorky's left, wanted to know if there was any truth to the rumor that the Central Committee was thinking of renaming Moscow Stalinodar. I can reveal, though it must go no further than this room, that the subject was raised, but Stalin flatly refused. Sholokhov, a favorite of Comrade Stalin's, asked the boss which, in his opinion, was the highest art, prose or playwriting or poetry. Stalin gave this some thought. Clearly poetry is head and shoulders above the other arts. Stalin talked about this very question the other day with the American writer Dos Passos, who is visiting us in connection with the Writers' Congress. Dos Passos agreed with my formulation and quoted the British novelist Morm, something to the effect that the poet makes the best of the prose writers look like a piece of cheese. That is also Stalin's opinion. Gorky, his voice pitched higher than usual, said, I cannot say I agree. The boss sucked noisily on his dead pipe. Nobody asks you to agree, he said in a tone so silkily pleasant, Gorky couldn't fail to understand that he had ventured onto a limb. The Khozayin didn't appreciate being contradicted in public. He once confided to me that it came close to being a criminal offense. At the far end of the long table, a young short story writer raised a finger. There is no need to ask permission to speak, Comrade Stalin instructed him. Here we are all equal. The young man scratched nervously at the stubble of a beard on his broad peasant's face. I would like to ask Comrade Stalin how a writer,
working in the obligatory aesthetic of socialist realism, is to deal with the question of collectivization. If we are to be realistic in form, we must portray the chaos, the distress. The only sound in the room came from outside the windows of the villa, automobiles klaxoning impatiently near a construction site at the foot of the hill. The Khuzayin leaned forward in order to get a better look at the speaker. "What is your name, comrade?"
"Sakadze. Sergo."
"Sakadze. Sergo," the boss repeated amiably. "Stalin thanks you for your intervention. So, inasmuch as collectivization of the peasants has been a catastrophic success, a certain amount of chaos and distress was inevitable. When a great socialist homeland moves to eliminate waste and poverty on a grand scale, stuff happens. You, the cultural workers who have the responsibility of justifying collectivization to the masses, must weigh the chaos and distress against what is being accomplished, and this must enter into your realistic portrait of the events in question. Collectivization is what makes industrialization possible. To slow down the tempo of collectivization will cripple industrialization, and that in turn will mean that our socialist republic will lag behind the West. And those who lag behind wind up in the dustbin of history. One only has to think back to old Russia. Because of her military, cultural, political, industrial, and agricultural backwardness, she was constantly being defeated. By the Mongol Khans, by the Polish-Lithuanian gentry, by the Anglo-French capitalists. Comrades, let us look reality in the eye. We are behind the leading industrial countries by 50 years. We must make up this difference in 10 years. Either that, or perish. This Adolf Hitler has a ravenous appetite. Mark my words. When he finishes stuffing himself in the West, he will turn eastward. We must be ready to welcome him with cold steel. Stalin and his Politburo colleagues believe we are capable of catching up before the inevitable war with Nazi Germany breaks out. You must never lose sight of the fact that we are armed with irrefutable scientific Marxism, which allows us to foresee the future and to divert the course of history. The capitalists live off religions that promise heaven after earth. We are holding out the prospect of heaven on earth. Our factory and our farm workers will be rewarded in this world for their labor, not in some afterlife. My boss aimed his index finger in Sakadze's direction. You ask how you are to deal with collectivization. Take your cue from Mikhail Alexandrovich here. With an effort, Comrade Stalin stiffly raised his crippled arm to indicate Sholokhov across the table. Take your cue from his masterly novel about collectivization, Virgin Soil Upturned. Stalin has read it twice. Comrade Sholokhov manages to dramatize Marx's aphorism about the absolute idiocy of rural life as it was organized under the Tsars. Gorky nodded in vehement agreement. If the enemy does not surrender, he said, looking around at the writers and editors, he must be exterminated. Comrade Stalin said reproachfully, Comrade Gorky, nobody aside from you has raised the question of extermination. Gorky blenched. I let myself get carried away by the justice of our cause, he mumbled. Sergo Sakadze started to raise a hand to speak again, then, like a child caught violating a rule, hurriedly retracted it. Comrade Stalin, anyone who keeps an ear to the ground knows that famine is spreading to large areas of the Ukraine. Yet according to Pravda, the Soviet Union continues to export grain. Why aren't we rushing food shipments to the hardest-hit areas instead of exporting to the West? The Khuzayin surveyed the faces around the table. Our comrade is a good storyteller, he declared. He invented the fiction of famine to frighten us. His heavy-lidded gaze fell on Sakadze. What do you write? Fables for morons? Where do you get your information? I get my information from my mother and my father who live in... Here he named a district in the Ukraine and a village in that district. I myself was born and raised in this village. Thanks to Bolshevik policies of egalitarianism, I finished secondary school and was admitted to university in Kiev, where I now teach. I have been a member of the party since before Lenin's death. According to the law on collectivization, kulaks who have children teaching in state schools are exempt from forced collectivization. Nevertheless, my parents were subject to the harshest repression by Czechists. So I ask you, Comrade Stalin, why my parents, who are small plot owners, what party propagandists call kulaks,
were not exempt from expropriation and forced collectivization as the law specified. I could tell from the boss's body language that he was irritated. His shoulders were listing to starboard. His feet were flat on the floor. He was chomping on the stem of his pipe as if he couldn't wait to suck on a cigarette. The fact is that collectivization went better and faster than we had anticipated, he finally said. At which point our people on the ground, dizzy with success, committed occasional excesses. They mistakenly identified a small number of middle peasants as kulaks. They used intimidation to force them into collectives. They confiscated their seed grain and cattle. Still, Stalin can tell you that the overall policy of collectivization is the right policy at the right time. Write down your name and that of your mother and father, as well as the name of their village. Stalin will have his people look into the matter. If it is determined that a wrong was done your parents, we will set it right. Minutes later, I accompanied a riled Hussein through the kitchen and the laundry room to the waiting automobile. One of Yagoda's Chekists held open the back door. Comrade Stalin handed me the piece of paper with Sakadze's name on it. "Fuck his mother," he said in an undertone, a soggy Kazbek paparosi glued to his lower lip. How did the prick get invited? Gorky. The Hussein was not pleased. It is the moral equivalent of wrecking to challenge the collectivization or raise the specter of famine in public. Have the organs check him out.